Hello and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, IEP coach, educational therapist, and mom who knows firsthand the ups and downs of navigating the special education journey. Today, we are diving into a conversation that so many families need. My guest, Dr. Karen Varblo, a neurodivergent specialist, pediatrician, and advocate who brings together experience in medication management, behavioral strategies, care coordination, and parent support. She's also a mom with lived neurodivergent experience herself, which means she truly understands both that professional side and the personal side of this work. So if you've ever felt like you're juggling two separate worlds, the healthcare at home and support at school, and wondering how to connect the dots for your kiddo, this episode is for you. Dr. Varblo and I are going to explore how parents can reframe behaviors, confidently navigate conversations about medication, and build stronger circles of care with teachers, doctors, and therapists. So grab a notebook because today's episode is packed with strategies you can take right into your next meeting at school, whether it's an IEP 504 or just a connection with your kiddo's teachers. Let's dive in. Hello and welcome, Dr. Varblo, for joining us today. I'm excited to really kind of talk about bridging health and school with neurodivergence and advocacy all wrapped into one powerful conversation. So thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Absolutely. Can you just tell our listeners just a real snapshot about who you are and kind of what brought you to this field?
Sure. And it was a windy road, I have to say. It was not a straight line.
Because they all are, right?
Right. So my first job out of college was working as a teacher in a residential treatment center for kids who were there for substance abuse residential treatment. So middle schoolers and high schoolers who were inpatient for 30 to 45 days. And I was helping them sort of get caught up with some of their schoolwork while they were there. That led me to want my MSW. So I went to social work school and I got most of the way through that program before I decided that I wanted to be a doctor. That meant that I had to take science classes that I'd never taken before for the pre-meds. So did that, went to medical school, became a pediatrician, and I worked in general pediatrics for several years. While I was in medical school, I myself was diagnosed with ADHD, and that was very enlightening to me and really started me down a journey of discovering and learning about neurodivergence broadly. While I was working as a general pediatrician, I started noticing that when I was trying to get treatment for my own kids and build a treatment team for my own kids, and when the parents who would come see me were trying to build teams for their kids, it was really difficult to find somebody who would create a coordinated, cohesive treatment plan for treating ADHD or other developmental challenges. And so I got really, really frustrated and decided that I would take it upon myself to learn everything I could learn about ADHD. So I went to, you know, the OTs and the PTs and the psychologists and the psychiatrists and all of the appointments and just soaked up every meeting I could find, every book I could read, soaked it all up and became my own care coordinator for my kids. And then decided that that might not be a bad service to provide to other people. So I started doing that, very quickly learned that ADHD rarely happens alone. So I've just been broadening and broadening and broadening my education ever since to include autism and anxiety and depression and tic disorders and OCD and all kinds of other things. So it's been a windy road, like I said, but it's a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. And I know folks can't see me at the moment unless they're watching on YouTube. And I'm shaking my head because I too had a similar experience with my son, my middle son, who's a brain cancer survivor, and realizing the medical world and the school world, and we talk about this on the show, operates often in silos, and having that core care coordinator is incredibly important because as parents, we're exhausted of trying to also, you know, work and maintain a house and all of the stuff that we juggle in life. So having that element to help parents communicate with either side of that silo and also the community, right? So you have home, you have healthcare, you have school, community, and really trying to keep all of these balls that are in the air kind of together for a family is incredible. And that's a lot of what I do at Learning Essentials as well, is helping parents take all the information, synthesize it, prioritize it, and then communicate with the team of folks that may be with a child, whether it's in the school day or outside the school day. Yeah.
It's so important, and it's so overwhelming as a parent and as a former primary care provider and social worker. The whole concept of having somebody to really coordinate all of the pieces was near and dear to my heart. So I'm thrilled also to be able to help with that.
Yeah, exactly. And before we kind of go into our conversation, I like to ask my guests, what is something that's little known about you, whether it's a hobby, traveling, whatever it may be, that doesn't necessarily relate to your current role as a professional?
I would say that I just love to be outside whenever possible. I like to be outside, fresh air, natural sunlight. That really feeds my soul.
Yes. And that
It's
sunlight
important to
is
me.
huge as we're getting ready to go into the fall and winter.
Right.
For sure. All right. So what does it look like? We're going to dive right in for
Okay.
families, right? To, again, like we said, they're carrying these maps of healthcare and school and home. What can it look like to weave those together so everyone on a kiddo's team, like we just sort of talked about, right? We mentioned that care coordinator. What does that look like so that everybody is really surrounding a student, a child, and supporting them?
It's funny because we do have this siloed approach. And what gets lost is the idea that there is one kiddo at the middle of it.
Yeah.
You know, this child is not just a student or just a patient or whatever. It's one child, one body, one mind, and one life. And when we can keep that as the central premise and tenet of our work, I think it's really helpful. You know, nobody learns at their best. Nobody is at their best if their brains and their bodies are not functioning well. So whatever the components are, they have to be integrated in order for the child to thrive. Parents can typically keep that in mind, but when they are sort of at the mercy of this big institution called the school system or the big institution called the healthcare system, it becomes overwhelming to try to keep everybody focused on the one child and their whole life. And that's why I feel like professionals, we all need to just work harder to help these parents feel like we are all integrating with each other to keep our focus on the one child. And I think that's true whether the health issue is sort of what we've traditionally cordoned off as mental health or cordoned off as physical health. Again, one child, one body, one mind, really trying to keep that all together. And the key there is communication. This can feel really daunting to parents. I think part of the challenge for parents is that they often feel like, or are sometimes treated like, they don't have any credibility in the conversation. There's this sort of, you know, excusing of ourselves that we do as parents where we say, you know I'm biased, it's my child, but here's what I see. And that can lead to their input being discounted, whether the parents sort of discount ourselves by excusing our bias, or whether the people that we're talking to, the professionals on the other side, discount us as sort of just the parent who's biased. But if we keep the communication open and equal, we can keep that focus more holistic. The other thing is that, you know, as a parent, when you feel like you're trying to sort of wrangle the healthcare system and the school system into conversations and into communication, it feels huge. But I like to really remember to dial it down to find a person, find a representative in each of those systems who will communicate with you and will receive communication. And then it doesn't feel quite so huge and impossible.
And I think that is it, right? In terms of, we want to empower our parents, whether it's representing themselves and their family at a school table or a medical table, that they do have this voice. They do know their babies. They have that instinct of something is not aligning, and empowering our parents with What can they do to communicate so they don't feel like they have to shrink or excuse themselves? And there's that value in also teaching parents how to collect data, whether it's, at home or in the community, whether it's mental, physical, cognitive, whatever the impact on a student is, be that data collector, get curious of how does this align to other students? And then how do I report that? My lens, just being an IEP coach and helping parents with the IEP process, is really with the school, but really it's the whole team that we're talking about. And I like that you say a representative, because if in the medical space or in the school space, you have this representative in the school space, it could be a case manager that's in charge of special education. If you're into that process or seeking an IEP, it could be the guidance counselor, but somebody that can really be a point person, even though you're going to be the head of that. But then you have these point people that can help them communicate with the team of this is what we're seeing, this is what this diagnosis is, and this is what it means for this particular child. Because we all know that even though we have a diagnosis, it looks very different for different kids.
100%. And rather than sort of consider how do I communicate that to the school, right? We need to bring make it all bite-sized and manageable. And you don't need to communicate it to the school. You need to communicate it to one person who gets it and will advocate for you and your child to the rest of the big system.
How can parents introduce, kind of thinking of that data point, how in your experience can parents introduce data from the medical in a way to the school that holds value?
You know, everybody has their own style. What I've noticed over the years is that there are people, some people like to communicate data in sort of spreadsheet form or questionnaires or as data. Other people like to communicate in narrative form. And so what I think is the most helpful thing that the parents can do is find out from the various parties what their preferred styles of communication are. And if the teacher likes to communicate via narrative, but the physician likes to receive information via questionnaires or charts, then maybe the parent can help translate the narrative into zeros and ones or what have you to provide it to the physician so that each party is communicating in their own language. And again, it's a heavy load for parents, but I do think that if we want the professionals to give and receive the information in the way that is most clear to them, then we need to work to be the translators as parents. The parents need to work to be the translators.
Or, yes, absolutely. Or seek somebody that can help them be the translator. Because
Yes.
oftentimes you have that fear and you have the love and you're trying to, and the overwhelm. So having somebody that can say, okay, this is what I'm seeing and let's kind of put this in order and this is where this could benefit. And speaking of this communication, families, I'm going to switch a little bit here, but families whisper, about medication. Some families are worried about the stigma or judgment. What are some misconceptions about kind of thinking of medication management and how parents can confidently share that information with schools or teams so that everybody has, knowledge is power? And so that is an important element of care for a student, for a child, is are they on medication? What does that look like? What does that mean? So, how can parents share that in a way that they feel comfortable and they feel confident?
To me, the medication piece is sometimes almost like a red herring. And I think that the real issue is not the medication itself, it's the difference. It's the fact that that this child is different in some way from their peers and needs supports that their peers don't need in order to thrive. So I think what makes a lot of people, parents, reticent to sort of talk about the medication is they're afraid that their child will be labeled somehow, or if the teachers or the school know that the child takes medication, that somehow that's going to lead to assumptions about their behavior or their character about their difference. And they sometimes parents, I think, hope that if they don't mention medication, nobody will notice the child's difference. And I see it differently. What I believe is that people see the behaviors in children that they see, right? Kids behave and people see that behavior. And when kids are struggling, it comes out in one way or another, and the adults in their lives see those struggles. If the adults don't know what the real reason is for the struggle, they're going to create a narrative in their own head to explain it. You know, and we as humans do this with each other constantly because we have to. We can't see each other's moral codes and value systems stamped on our foreheads. All we can see is each other's behaviors, and we make assumptions based on those behaviors. And for about 90-ish percent of the world, that's pretty fair. Because for most of the world, behavior is driven by the moral code, the value system, the goals, and the true self. The problem with ADHD and some of these other conditions that we're talking about is that there are other factors that are sometimes driving the behaviors. If the adults in this child's world don't know that, they're going to assume that it's possibly a character problem, a moral failing, a cognitive failing, parenting failing. They make up stories to explain why the child is behaving in certain ways. In my experience, the narratives that are created are almost never as kind or simple as, oh, they have ADHD, or oh, they're autistic. Well, oh, I just thought they were stinkers, or I just thought they were stupid, or I just thought that they were rude, or whatever it is, fill in the blank. So to me, when we can let people know the real reasons for the child's behaviors, what's driving them, and equally as importantly, what's going to help them to thrive, then all of those, the problems and the judgment and everything that can come with the incorrect narrative can go away. The child is thriving better. The child is exposed to much less judgment and much less sort of disconnect, right? Much less incorrect assumptions about who they are, and everything just sort of, the you know, individual people are better able to connect when we get each other and can support each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, and I think I always say this, that kids don't wake up wanting to be a jerk.
Right.
It's just not that way. And so when you have these heavy labels by adults saying defiance or avoidance, it's always like, but what is the cause of that, right? Is
yes.
it a drive for autonomy? Is it sensory? Is it attention? You know, what is causing this? And then to be able to say, okay, now I better understand it. Because you're right, oftentimes people can look at something and have their perception of it, even
sure.
though their perception is not doesn't always have to be or is not reality. And so figuring out, you know, looking at behavior and thinking of it as communication, and then being able to reframe that information so that staff and other support people that are around your kiddo most of the day see that as, oh, okay, Susie's trying to communicate something to me. And this is, you know, and here I am, the steward of this information. How can I help guide this child? Because oftentimes, from what I've learned and seen, that once students have whatever that behavior is, they feel guilty. They don't necessarily, you know, there are times that, you know,
so true.
And that's a whole other podcast, but
right.
But they feel guilty. They feel shame. They feel
remorse.
And then now
yeah.
You're like remorse. And now we're piling on traumas. And now,
yes.
You know, which then can lead to school avoidance and this whole thing. So what then, can we just talk a little bit maybe about some hidden messages that are behind behaviors like refusal or meltdown or even masking? Right?
Right.
We have students
Right.
that come home and have masked all day. And then, you know, have you ever seen some hidden messages? And then how can we help our parents and listeners decode some of those patterns?
That is where the money is. I mean, that's really the ticket. And so, you know, sometimes the messages that kids are trying to communicate through their behavior, sometimes the messages are intentional. and the kids are doing in the best way they know how something specific to try to get a message across. Other times, there actually is no message other than the child is impulsive and can't and doesn't have the self-control to inhibit some of their behaviors. And so the message is not so much in the content of the behavior, but in the fact that it wasn't, that the child doesn't have the self-control to inhibit it. So it can be a little tricky how much interpretation, how much weight we give the sort of the content of the behavior, because sometimes it just doesn't mean what it looks like it means. It just means that with more self-control, the child would change their behavior because their behavior is not being driven by their sort of rational, logical part of their brain. So it can be tricky, but I think, like you, you know, I believe that kids just want approval. They want to please people. They want to feel accepted and loved and valued as they are. And so if they're behaving in ways that don't move in that direction, we do need to ask why. And if they are achieving that goal all day in school, but the toll that it's taking is so intense that by the time they get home, they have nothing left in the tank, then we need to understand that too. So sometimes I think the specific behavior is of less relevance than the fact that there is a behavior, right? And getting to what is actually driving the child to behave that way, because if they had the gas in the tank, the self-control, and the ability to sort of read the room, chances are they would do what they need to do to get a different response from the world.
I would love your insight on, we talk about educational impact for an IEP, right? And like that bell to bell, everything in between, not only academics, but again, just processing memory and attention, social, emotional, sensory, physical, communication, all of those things. What advice do you have for schools that say, for a student that's masking, and then the school's like, well, they're doing fine here, but when they come home, they're falling apart? Have you heard any conversations about that?
Absolutely. It's much, much more common than most people believe.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
it can be really confusing because, again, it looks like the child is communicating something to the parents that has to do with the parents, when in fact, what they're communicating to the parents at home after school is about the school. So it can be very confusing. You know, one of the things that our culture gets really wrapped up in is praise. And I don't think that we always really consider the impact of the praise that we give. So for example, when somebody is praised for sort of complying with a request, if complying with the request actually sort of goes against their grain and takes a huge toll on them, it's not necessarily what we actually want for the child, and it's not necessarily what we actually want to reinforce or value or highlight. So if a child wants praise, which who doesn't, and gets it by complying, even when there's something that feels off about it to them, sort of at a deeper level, we are not praising them for who they are. We're praising them for who they're masking to be, pretending to be, which again reinforces this whole idea that people have to mask in order to be accepted and loved, which burns up the gas in their tank. And we end up in this cycle. Whereas if we can praise kids for things that are more unique to who they are and specific to who they are, rather than they're just sort of following the rules, and we can build connections that are authentic, then we are less likely to be sort of encouraging the child to burn through the gas in their tank too quickly. And we can teach them how to get through life a day, a week, you know, a quarter authentically, which saves everybody so much distress and hardship.
Yeah. So what language then can help shift? We're at a meeting, right? And we're trying to communicate this as an adult about a student, about their kiddo. What language helps shift that meeting away from some blame towards problem solving?
Right. So again, if there's blame, there's what people are blaming on somebody has to do with sort of undesirable behavior or undesired behaviors, right? So the child is behaving in some way that is not making somebody happy. And that somebody, whether it's the teacher or whomever, is trying to understand the source of the behavior. They come up with a narrative, and that narrative might be the child is to blame because of their poor character or what have you, or the parent is to blame because of their poor parenting skills or whatever. When we can shift the whole approach from sort of coming down on somebody for doing it wrong and shift to like, how can we support you from beneath and help you do better? Blame then sort of is irrelevant, right? The question is, how can we support this child or support this family or support this teacher so that they can more easily work together with each other in productive ways? And if that's where we're coming from, then the blame really ceases to be part of the conversation.
And wouldn't we have a phenomenal society if we all had that mindset
Right.
regardless of supporting a kiddo or just, how can we be a light brightener for a human? I think is really just
Right?
a focus,
How can we
right?
support each other in this difficult situation? We can all acknowledge that it's difficult. So, okay, let's get beyond acknowledging that and move to how can we support each other?
So talking about the care management and coordination, parents tend to get stuck feeling like trying to do it all, right? And they're going to get burnt out because they're, again, have a thousand balls in the air trying to navigate. How can parents know when to push, when to delegate, when to rest?
Oh, you
It's a
know, I
million dollar
think,
question, right?
right? It is. I think, boy, parents have a lot to balance. You know, there's always the sort of airplane model where you have to sort of put your own oxygen mask on first before you put it on your child or the people around you who need your help. Because if you pass out, you're no good to anybody. And I think that that's valid. And I think it's challenging when people feel like they are in crisis. You know, nobody functions at their best when they're in crisis. And these parents often feel like they're in crisis, and these kids often feel like they're in crisis, and sometimes the teachers feel like they're in crisis, and sometimes the physicians do. And the more everybody is like not thinking clearly, the more everybody's spinning their wheels and nothing productive is happening. So I think the first thing to do is like, let's just take a big deep breath, because if there's sort of no blood and no fire, we have time to take a big deep breath. So let's do that, right? And then prioritize. We need to think through things sort of systematically. Maybe the first step is getting a better understanding of what is driving your child's behaviors. And that might mean that we have to start with a comprehensive neuropsych assessment if that hasn't yet been done. So let's put that front and center and not so much sweat the what do I do in this situation and what do I do in that situation? We don't know yet. So breathe is the answer to what do you do in this or that situation until we have more information. And then once we have that information, then we're building an appropriate team of professionals who have insights and experience and expertise in various ways of supporting your child, depending on their needs. So we're building that team. We're facilitating the communication between those team members, like we talked about at the beginning, and we are always learning. We're always learning. We're not always getting it right. Sometimes we do a lot of learning by default, by process of elimination, right? We tried that. Nope. Tried that. Oh, nope. That wasn't it either. But we'll get there and we're still learning and we're still making progress. And to keep in mind that nobody buddy is perfect. And all we can do is keep learning and keep moving forward and keep the communication open and keep supporting each other the best way we can.
And knowledge is certainly power. So if a parent could hand a teacher a one page about their kiddo, is there anything that you would recommend that would really capture, I want to say the strengths as well. I really do want to start with the strengths because I am a firm believer that we could take those strengths to support any learning gaps or needs holistically, wherever that may be, in a neuroaffirming way. What would you recommend that the school can then actually use for a student that you don't have to tell the whole story, but how do we do a one page that's powerful that really then sets the stage of this is who my baby is?
Yeah, I love this question, and I do recommend that parents do this at the beginning of each school year because I think it can be enormously helpful. And I do like to start with the strengths. Have the parents sort of draw a little verbal picture of what it looks like when their child is thriving. What does it look like when they are doing the things they do well and shining so that we know what the goal is. Now we have what we're shooting for. And then I like to frame these letters in terms of what's worked in the past for other teachers because we have history, we have experience, we hopefully have had teachers along the way up to this point who have figured out ways to connect with the child and bring out their best. So that would be the next thing that I would like to focus on is, sometimes, or what I've been told from other teachers in the past is when X, then the best thing to do is Y. Or, when you see A, it really helps to do B. And you're not telling the teacher how to teach your child or how to do their job. You're just giving them the benefit of prior experience and saying, I trust you with my child. And I know that sometimes being my child's teacher can be frustrating and it can be hard. It can be challenging. I acknowledge that. And I don't want you to get frustrated. I don't want you to have a harder time than you need to have. So here are some tips that have been helpful to other people along the way. Please let me know if there's anything I can do to support you in other ways as the year progresses. Make yourself an ally and let the teacher know how to know if they're getting it right, based on what has been seen in the past.
Yeah, and I think that's incredibly important. And I also share, here's my phone number. You can text it, you can call it. Here's the best email. This is the easiest way to get a hold of me so that if another professional has questions, they can come back. And, some parents only like texting, some parents, and conversely, some teachers only like, forms of communication. So I think it's very helpful to put all of that information out there. Speaking of communication, some families, they may not be able to attend every meeting or they may not be able to email every day. Is there kind of a weekly practice for families that you've recommended to kind of stay ahead, whether it's, a Sunday night, a Friday reflection, a 2-minute check-in that really kind of keep health and school on the same page?
Again, that brings me back to sort of how do the professionals prefer to receive the information, right? Again, some prefer sort of zeros and ones and some prefer narratives. I think that we first, as parents, we first want to sort of identify what information do the various parties want and how do they want to receive it. Not everybody wants a four-page narrative every Monday morning to start the week with, right? But some people do. Some people would find that very helpful, maybe. So, figuring out what information does the professional need and what's the best way that for them to receive it. Sometimes that means working with the professional to figure out what questionnaire or survey or chart works best. I think it's independent, but it's back to the communication piece. Am I reading your question right?
So, no, absolutely. And it is understanding that communication piece and being able to share some reflections as a parent of this is what's happening at the home, the community. This is also what we're hearing from school in a way that doesn't overload the other professionals, but in a way that still keeps that biggest impact over time, whether it's a small routine of, I've had parents use the recording app on their phone to send just a speaking message and whatever way makes sense. And also coming up with a school home communication as well, whether it's a living document that people can follow and share. So having kind of those out of the box conversations at a meeting to really establish what can that strong communication look like
exactly.
for all parties. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's
yeah.
important. What advice do you have for parents that may freeze in a meeting, right? So that they may just be able to have like a little script they can use when they just feel whatever they may feel. And or if a school dismisses their concerns or pushes back, is there a script that you like to share with families that they can kind of keep in their back pocket so that they do feel like, all right, here, you know, this is neutralizes the conversation and there's a sets this collaborative tone for a meeting.
Yeah, it can be really intimidating to be in some of these meetings, especially when things are not going well for your child, either at school or at home or both. And it and you're worked to the bone and it's just and you feel judged. That can be really hard. And it's common, I think, for parents to freeze. I think having, again, remembering to breathe, literally, I mean, really, like, take a big deep breath. Remembering to do that can be hard. But I do think that's, like, make that the mantra for when, you know, for throughout the, breathe, 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 breathe. Okay. And I think being authentic is generally the most effective style of communication. So I think it's okay to say, I'm getting a little overwhelmed. Give me a second. And then to say something like, you know, I realize that my child is not the easiest kid to have in a classroom of with 29 other children. You know, I realize that he or she can be a challenge. Trust me, I get that. And here's the thing, like my kiddo is not a 50th percentile kind of a kiddo. Right? They have real strengths. They have real challenges. And their brains work differently from the 50th percentile kids' brains. And so everybody has found it helpful in the past. Again, I'm going back to previous teachers. Everybody has found it helpful in the past. If we can figure out how to make the child feel supported, if we can make the child feel supported, trust me, everything else will get easier. So can we focus on that? And the way to support my kiddo is not necessarily going to look anything like the way that you usually support most of your kids. And there are ways, you know, so when we think about tracking development over time and growth, and then we take a snapshot of different areas of development, you know, if we could measure not only sort of height, weight, head circumference, BMI, language acquisition, language expression, language reception, you know, like all of these things that we measure. But if we could also measure, you know, art appreciation and ability to read the room and all of these different things and plot them based on percentile. If we have a 10-year-old child whose art appreciation is at the 90th percentile, but whose verbal expression is at the 10th percentile and whose gross motor coordination and development are at the 50th percentile. I said a 10-year-old child, right? So if the child is 10, 90th and 10th and 50th, what that actually means is that when it comes to appreciating music, the child is developmentally equivalent to say a 15-year-old, because the raw score that is the 90th percentile for a 10-year-old is the raw score that is, say, the 50th percentile for a 15-year-old, for example. Okay. And then we take the verbal expression and we say, okay, they're at the 10th percentile. Well, that raw score might actually be the 50th percentile for a 5-year-old. So in any one conversation, when a teacher is giving any one set of instructions, when we're getting through any one lesson, we're dealing with a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 15-year-old all in one. And it's really confusing, really confusing. The more we can get our heads around, like, we are not going to get this child who's developmentally 5 in this arena to behave like the 10-year-old peers. So stop expecting that of them. Let's start expecting them to be five in that arena and support them the way we would support a five-year-old, even though it feels like coddling or it feels inappropriate or it feels however wrong it feels, if that's where the child is developmentally and that's what they need, then that's what we need to do.
And that is a very clear way, I think, to express that to teams, of just a great visual of using data, right, to identify these lagging skills, to identify these super strengths, and to put it in that framework, especially if you are writing IEP goals.
Yes.
To be able to take, okay, because if I am saying a baseline at this age and my expectation is to move this student forward, we really have to start at that data point and that present level of performance so that we can then say, this is a more appropriate goal. Because if we have a goal that is misaligned,
yes,
that student's never going to reach it. And then people are going to be frustrated. The student's going to be
frustrated.
Everybody's
going to be frustrated.
That's yep. right. So I yeah. think that is really incredible to be able to do for teams, again, whether it's outside the school day or inside the school day, but specifically inside the school day, so that we can then set up, because, you know, we know the crux of our IEP development is that present level of performance, the parent input statement, and then taking that, because needs drive services. And so needs drive goals, who then in turn drive services. So if we're able to really take that data that's given and formulate goals and services, we are really then at the heart of an individualized educational program or plan.
Yes. Yes. And the thing is, it's hard for people to get their heads around, like, but they're so amazing at this, that, or the other thing. How yeah. can it be that they can't tie their shoes? Well, I don't know, but they can't. So, like, let's just accept that they are way ahead in some ways and way behind in others, and they're right on track in certain ways, and try not to get too wrapped up in those contradictions, because we're all walking contradictions in our own ways, right? These kids more so than the 50th percentile kid. So if we can sort of, yes, use this data point and say, think of him as five, or her as five, when we're in this arena of development. And yes, think of them as 14 or 15 when we're in that arena of development. And I know that that's really hard to fit into one conversation or one set of directions, but that's where they are. That's where they are.
Yeah, I think that is really critical for that understanding and to the really truly support a student just from that data standpoint. And that's
yes.
really what we want. And that's how we can then understand. And even if we don't have a full neuropsych for a student, really framing it of that way as well, we may not have metrics, but their metrics can look very different, right? And
yes.
so whether
yes.
that's observation or whatever that may look like, you know, in this arena, here's our strengths. Here's our, you know, superpowers. In this arena, we have these lagging skills, and this is what it looks like. Because I think that dichotomy that you laid out can be very confusing for professionals when they're supporting a student, because they do see these higher skills, that 15-year-old brain in there, but then they also see these very premature skills that are lagging. And so how do we bolster one and use the other to really come together to support a kid?
Absolutely. The other thing that can be confusing, I'll just say, is sometimes these kids, for whatever reason, will take one of those lagging skills and knock it out of the park. They will perform phenomenally. And then the world says, ah, I knew you could do it. The fact that you haven't been doing it must mean that you are willfully being difficult. Right? You're willfully obstructing this process. Because I've seen you do it. I know you can. What we have to keep in mind is that the reason they knocked it out of the park that one day was because of who knows what, the stars aligned in just the right way or something that we will never understand. But it actually doesn't mean that when the stars aren't aligned that way, that they can do it. So the physical ability to complete a task once does not mean that in real life, an individual can consistently perform the same task at the same level. Sometimes they need more support for whatever reason. and sometimes they need less support for whatever reason. What I like to remind parents and teachers is that what they can expect on an ordinary day is what they can expect on an ordinary day. It's what they see on an ordinary day. The fact that once, months ago, it happened phenomenally well has no bearing on the ordinary day. And so let's focus on where the child is now and support them in the ways that they need right now.
Yeah, and none of us perform consistently day after day, you know, right? Pinpoint straight. There's going to be dips, there's going to be highs, you know, and in that is also a lot of information, right? So
right.
When it was really well, and you alluded to that, were there supports or was it just, you know, and understanding that and understanding human behavior that is also very challenging or can
right.
be in that sense, but really setting that stage of, yes, this is, they can do it, but let's look at other factors that may be coming into play and how to support that. And I'm saying all this, and I know it's not easy from a teacher perspective in a classroom, a lot of moving parts. It's not. So I do find that it is empowering for the voices to say, okay, this is what can go well. And this is how can we set it up in an environment that's not adding to a teacher's plate, but being right. able to help the teacher in that process.
When we consider the fact that, you know, anger, disappointment, frustration, all of these sorts of negative emotions are essentially the result of unmet expectations. Sometimes the most important thing we can help people do is set appropriate expectations, because then if things go as you expect, it's as you expect. There's no problem necessarily, right? Because you were anticipating exactly what happened. And so by helping the teacher set appropriate expectations, even though you have seen this happen, you know, I often say that nobody calls me in September. My phone is dead in September. And I call the phone company every year and say, like, is something wrong with my phone? Because everybody's on their best behavior,
uh-huh.
right? These kids are knocking it out of the park often in September. Their gas tanks are full from a summer of low demand and, you know, fun and positive reinforcement. And they're trying really hard to make a good first impression. Likewise with the teachers, like everybody's on their best behavior. Maybe the expectations that we have for October, November, December shouldn't be linear from where they started in September. If we know that about a kid, you know, by the time December comes around, things tend to get really challenging in this way or that way. So know to expect that can be really powerful.
Absolutely.
I think.
And those are some of my busier months.
October, exactly.
November,
right?
December.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. You know.
So as we wind down, what is one thing that I didn't know enough or I should have asked that we haven't talked about?
That's a great question. Here's what I would say. These kids can be and can appear to be oblivious to a lot of things and unaware of, not receptive to a lot of feedback. And in my experience, for whatever reason, they also tend to be exquisitely, exquisitely sensitive to what I call sort of negative vibes. Vibes of disappointment, of frustration, of, you know, just sort of giving up and disapproval. And so as much as we, the adults in these kids' worlds, feel like we are doing a good job of sort of not vocalizing some of our anger, frustration, disappointment, disapproval, I promise you that the kids are picking it up at like a molecular level or something. So it's not just that we need to not say the things out loud, make the disapproving statements out loud. We really, the adults in these kids' worlds really do need to adjust our expectations and learn how to get more out of these kids for their benefit and ours, and find the ways to see the positive, because these kids just, it's bizarre how much they can miss and be oblivious to, but how just incredibly, exquisitely sensitive they can be to approval and disapproval messages. So
absolutely.
I think that's an important point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought it up, especially, you know, we have our super sensors as kids in that profile and really picking up and honing in on that little shift that may be. And I do want to add, including kids in the conversation when it's appropriate for that child's level, whether it's cognitive or where they may be, but really just understanding and asking them, including them, of, we're making these plans, but really let's not forget who's at the heart of these plans is our kiddos and what works well for you in school. What doesn't work
100%.
well for you? And our kids will sing like canaries and let you
Yes.
know,
Yes.
this is working, this is not. And I think that's also really important to add to our conversation today.
There's an exercise that I often do with the older kids, maybe, high school and college aged kids, and I ask them about the time that they knocked it out of the park, whatever it was, right? The time that they were so behind and they were failing the class and they realized that if they didn't somehow get the information into their brains before the final, they would fail the whole class and have to take it again. And they somehow learned a whole semester's worth of information in 4 days and aced the final and passed the class. Like, I want to know, what did that look like? Where were you studying? Were you studying by yourself? Were you studying with other people? Were you in a really quiet, sort of white room in the library? Or were you at a Starbucks where there's lots of energy around you and people are accomplishing all kinds of things? Did you have music playing? Honestly, for the musicians, I want to know if the music was coming from earbuds or the speakers were in front of you or behind you, because I've had musicians tell me it makes a difference to their motivation and how energized they get by the music. I want to know every detail, the lighting, everything about what supported you that time that it really, really worked. And let's try to recreate that as much as we can, even if it goes against sort of conventional wisdom of, no, you need a place with no distractions, and Starbucks is a horrible place to do your homework or whatever. The traditional sort of way of thinking is,
You had one final tip for a parent for a billboard. What would it be and why?
listen to your kids. They will tell us. They will tell us everything we need to know if we can close our mouths long enough to listen. Close our mouths, open our ears. They will tell us everything we need to know.
Well, Dr. Varbo, I appreciate your time today and all of your tips and information. How can folks find you?
So my website is www.drkarenmd.com, and it's Karen with an I. So DrKarenmd.com. And you can always reach me through my website. My phone number is there. And I look forward to hearing from lots of folks.
Yeah,
This is my
absolutely.
topic of interest, so I'm always happy to talk about
We'll
it.
have all that information in the show notes. So thank you so much, and we appreciate your time.
Wendy, thank you so much. This was really a pleasure.
Wow, what an incredible conversation with Dr. Varbo. I hope you feel a little lighter, more empowered, and ready to see yourself not as the observer, but that CEO of your kiddos' care team. I want you to see if you can take one small way to connect the dots between home and school this week. That could be sending a short snapshot of your kiddo to their teacher, starting a 2-minute weekly reflection on what worked and what didn't, or practicing a go-to script for your next meeting. One step at a time is all going to add up to that real powerful advocacy. So if this episode encouraged you, please like, follow, and share the Special Ed Strategist with another parent who needs support. Together, we can change the way schools and families partner with our kiddos. Again, I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, IEP coach, educational therapist, and your guide on this journey. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.